Hello, I'm Susanna Tresillian. Before you get started with this edition of the Books podcast, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the end of year Guardian Books podcast. How did you spend Christmas?
I had spent this time thinking about my own insignificance.
Clearly it has been a tough year for many, and that might have made an impact on the tone of this podcast.
What is truth? What is objective reality? Is there really any such thing?
We'll cover some of the most talked about topics of the year, from
the idea that fiction that is set in the past is in some way cowardly or irrelevant is absolutely ludicrous. Good historical fiction is not about the past, it is about now.
To
do you dog-ear books?
No.
You see, I am a dog-earer, and I think that readers divide into two categories.
Well, because I eat a lot of noodles, and I read while I... So I've decided ages ago that I was never going to keep my books pristine.
Because you have noodles all over them.
Splatter. It's just noodles and spaghetti all over my books all the time.
Well, line up your books, in whatever condition they might be, because here we are, finally marking the end of 2016. Only to find that the year's big winners, by one benchmark at least, are yet to be crowned. That benchmark is the Costa Book Awards, which reward books in five categories: fiction, first novel, biography, poetry, and children's books. What we on the Guardian Books Desk love about these awards is that they draw attention to an often overlooked truth of the literary calendar. While publishers and newspapers big up authors and books at the point of hardback publication, it's only when those books come out in affordable paperbacks that many real readers get going. In that spirit, we'll be chatting about the books we think deserve to find their place in the new year. But first to the Costas, which, in their previous incarnation as the Whitbreads, were founded way back in 1971. The shortlists for the five categories feature 20 fabulous writers, and notably in the two fiction sections, the historical novel looms large. Francis Spufford is nominated for his first novel. Golden Hill is set in New York, when New York was very new indeed, just a small town on the tip of Manhattan Island. It's 1746, and a single man in possession of a good fortune has just arrived in search of... what exactly? Well, nobody knows, and it's this mystery that plays a hugely entertaining homage to the literature of the period. Sarah Perry is nominated in the fiction category for her second novel, The Essex Serpent, which has already been named Book of the Year by UK booksellers Waterstones. It takes us forward a century in pursuit of a terrifying monster that's rumoured to roam the marshes of East Anglia, looking out for careless humans. Sarah and Francis joined Claire Armitstead in the studio, and Sarah began by reading from the opening of her book.
A young man walks down by the banks of the Blackwater under the full cold moon. He's been drinking the old year down to the dregs until his eyes grew sore and his stomach turned and he was tired of the bright lights and bustle. "I'll just go down to the water," he said, and kissed the nearest cheek. "I'll be back before the chimes." Now he looks east to the turning tide, out to the estuary, slow and dark, and the white gulls gleaming on the waves. It's cold, and he ought to feel it, but he's full of beer, and he's got on his good thick coat. The collar rasps at the nape of his neck, he feels fuddled and constricted, and his tongue is dry. "I'll go for a dip," he thinks, "that'll shake me loose," and coming down from the path stands alone on the shore, where deep in the dark mud all the creeks wait for the tide. "I'll take a cup of kindness yet," he sings in his sweet chapel tenor, then laughs, and someone laughs back. He unbuttons his coat, he holds it open, but it's not enough, he wants to feel the wind's edge strop itself sharp on his skin. Nearer he goes to the water and puts out his tongue to the briny air. Yes, I'll go for a dip, he thinks, dropping his coat on the marsh. He has done it before, after all, when a boy and in good company. The brave tomfoolery of a midnight dip as the old year dies in the new year's arms. The tide's low, the wind's dropped, the black water holds no fear. Give him a glass and he'd drink it down, salt and seashell, oyster and all. But something alters in a turn of the tide or a change of the air. The estuary surface shifts, seems, he steps forward, to pulse and throb, then grow slick and still, then soon after to convulse as if flinching at a touch. Nearer he goes, not yet afraid. The gulls lift off one by one and the last gives a scream of dismay. Winter comes like a blow to the back of his neck. He feels it penetrate his shirt and go into his bones. The good cheer of drink is gone and he is comfortless there in the dark. He looks for his coat, but clouds hide the moon and he's blind. His breath is slow. The air is full of pins. The marsh at his feet all at once is wet, as if something out there has displaced the water. Nothing, it's nothing, he thinks, patting about for his courage, but there it is again, a curious still moment, as if he were looking at a photograph, followed by a frantic, uneven motion that cannot be merely the tug of the moon on the tides. He thinks he sees, is certain he sees, the slow movement of something vast, hunched, grimly covered over with rough and lapping scales, then it is gone. In the darkness, he grows afraid. There is something there. He feels it, biding its time, implacable, monstrous, born in water, always with an eye cocked in his direction. Down in the deeps it slumbered, and up it's come at last. He imagines it breasting the wave, avidly scenting the air. He is seized by dread. His heart halts with it. In the space of a moment, he's been charged, condemned, and brought to judgment. Oh, what a sinner he's been, what a black pip there is at his core. He feels ransacked, emptied of all goodness. He has nothing to bring to his defence. Out he looks to the black, black water, and there it is again. Something cleaving the surface, then subsiding. Yes, all along it's been there, waiting, and at last it's found him out. He feels a curious calm. Justice must be done, after all, and he willingly pleads guilty. It's all remorse and no redemption and no less than he deserves. But then the wind lifts and tugs the covering cloud and the shy moon shows her face. It's a scant light, to be sure, but a comfort. And there, after all, is his coat, not a yard away, muddy at the hem. The gulls return to the water and he feels completely absurd. From the path above him comes the sound of laughter, a girl and her boy in their festival clothes. He waves and calls, I'm here, I'm here. And I am here, he thinks, here on the marsh he knows better than his home, with the tide slowly turning and nothing to fear. Monstrous, he thinks, laughing at himself, giddy with reprieve, as if there were anything out there but herring and mackerel. Nothing to fear in the black water. Nothing to repent, only a moment of confusion in the darkness and far too much to drink. The water comes to meet him, and it's his old companion again. To prove it, he draws nearer, wets his boots, holds out his arms. Here I am, he yells, and all the gulls reply. Just a quick dip, he thinks, for auld lang syne, and laughing slips free of his shirt. The pendulum swings from one year to the next, and there's darkness on the face of the deep.
Gosh, it's so fabulously atmospheric. You can see the bubbling up of superstition there. And this is a novel which entwines superstition and science and religion and a serpent. They're sort of all three are symbolised by a serpent. You have Asclepius and the serpent around his staff, the god of healing. You have, obviously, the serpent in Eden. And you have this mythological creature that may or may not exist in Blackwater. Tell us about this story and how it came about.
I was driving through the countryside seaside with my husband, and he'd been reading this old book published in the 1930s called Companion into Essex. And one of the chapters in this book is called A Whale and Some Other Stories, or words to that effect. And we passed a village sign to a village called Henham on the Mount, and Robert, my husband, said, "Have you heard of the Essex Serpent?" And I said, "No." And he told me that in 1669, a great beast had been seen menacing the local villages, and that they were so worried about it that they'd produced these woodcuts saying strange news out of Essex. And there is a woodcut of a beast with wings and huge eyes and a beak menacing men with lances who were sort of poking at it. And I immediately thought, what would happen if the Essex Serpent came back after Darwin, long after Darwin, when ideas of paleontology and natural history were very much in common currency, when the roots of kind of a fundamentalist Christian faith were very shaken by developments in science, and how would people treat it? And it seemed to me to be a great way of examining the conflict that I think resides in all of us to some extent between our reason, you know, what we see and what we understand of the world, and our fears that we can't quite explain. And so, yeah, that's the genesis of the story.
And your central characters are a recently widowed fossil hunter who's very modern and looks like a bag lady, basically, doesn't she? And so she sort of rather shocks all the local people.
Yeah.
And her companion stroke servant, who is a socialist, who's sort of concerned with slum clearance.
Yeah.
And then the local vicar. Tell us about these characters.
One of the things that I was really interested in doing was taking a kind of trope character that feels very familiar from Victorian fiction and inverting them somewhat. So we have Martha, who's a relatively working class companion, but working class women towards the end of the 19th century were, as women are now, very interested in social change, in politics, in trade union movements. They were kind of striving, interesting women. So I thought, rather than having a mob-capped, deferential companion, have a fascinating, strong, politically aware, working-class character. And then I wanted to have a vicar, but to interrogate the idea that those who have faith are the most irrational. So actually, Will Ransom, the vicar in the village where the serpent is seen, is among the most level-headed of the people there. His faith is a very rational faith, and he's trying to get people to stop panicking by appealing to a reasoned religion. So all along, I was trying to sort of take these ideas of characters that feel familiar and then turn them upside down in some way.
So what is scary is public hysteria.
Yes, really, absolutely.
It?
Yeah. The most frightening moments, I hope, are where you can't see anything, but somebody thinks they can. So a moment of mass hysteria amongst school children, the young man thinking that he sees something, and these kind of inherited dread, and the way we project onto these things our own terrors. It's a kind of core of the Gothic that we invest our own fears and our own anxieties into these kind of nebulous, half-glimpsed things in a corridor.
Right, I'm going to park that now, and we're going to turn to Frances Spufford, whose novel is actually very different. It's, for a start, it's set in the 18th century, and it is very much entwined with the style of the 18th century rather than the 19th century. Frances, tell us a bit about Golden Hill.
Well, actually, I can see a number of similarities and connections immediately to Sarah's book, but it is rooted in a different century and in a different century's connections to the present, because I was interested in the ways in which 1746, in the tiny, very small colonial town of New York, reflects unexpectedly back bits of the present. The book is about a smiling, plausible, handsome, yet somehow unwilling to be straightforward young man with a suspicious name of Mr. Smith, who turns up in Manhattan at a point when there are only about 7,000 people there, with a piece of paper drawn on a London bank, which is either worth a fortune or worth nothing at all if it's fraudulent. And at that time, it takes about 5 or 6 weeks to get across the Atlantic. So in order to verify whether you're dealing with a con man or a suspicious person who should still be paid the £1,000 they're asking for, takes about 10 to 12 weeks, which gives the book its frame. The book takes place while nobody knows yet who Mr. Smith is and what he's doing there, which includes the reader, because I managed ruthlessly and cruelly to keep back until pretty much the last page, and even the last paragraph at the last page, the whole of the explanation of what's going on.
It's very naughty, that, isn't it? I mean, I couldn't... It's naughty, but it's also... It's completely delightful.
Well, I like being teased by books like that, so I did it as much as I could to my reader, thinking, well, I would be pleasing myself here, so I certainly hope I'm pleasing somebody else.
Will you do give us a reading? Because we'll get a sense of how different the style is.
The style is partly me inhabiting the bits I enjoy of 18th century prose, as you'll hear. The long room the doorway opened on had western windows, a pair of them letting in the day's last glow of light, rather the silver of rain than of the metal, streaked with a faint crimson, admitting to the distant existence of the sun, brilliant light to Mr. Smith, and it burnished with borrowed brilliance the faces of the three young women in the room, plain-dressed among the plain furniture. One, fair-headed, was standing at the window with her hand to her mouth. One, darker, was sitting and reading something. And one, an African servant in a white kerchief, was holding a taper to a fresh white candle. When they saw him at the door, they all turned and looked at him. He looked back. What a difference a frame makes! To Mr. Smith, gazing inward, the uprights of the painted door seemed to set out the three of them like some tableau representing the new world itself, of which his acquaintance to this point totaled 47 minutes, and which, therefore, he could not yet feel to be entirely solid, entirely terra firma, as ordinarily founded on its bed of earth, but only to constitute a kind of scene, backed by drops and flats, where you must step forth at your cue to act your part, ready or not, ignorant as yet of the temper of the audience, ignorant of the temper of the other players, which will so much determine the drama you compose together, turn by turn, speech by speech, line by line. The blonde one was extremely pretty, with a wide mouth of candid pink. The dark one, not much less so, though she seemed to have just left off scowling, and her brows met in a knot. The African was turning eyes black as licorice on him in a gaze of perfect blankness. What was more, what seemed to him a rarity fitting them to model the three graces, none of the three was in the slightest marked by the pox. He would learn that this exemption was, in the colony, almost too common to deserve notice, but it had, for the moment, the force of an original astonishment. Thus, Smith, on the one side, gazing in. To the three gazing outwards, however, into the dark of the stairwell, where a face had bloomed and two pale hands clutching paper, he had only appeared in the ordinary aperture of an ordinary day. For them, the blue-grey pediment of Connecticut pine faced the everyday world as it always did, and they were their everyday selves, well launched, it seemed to them, into the middle of their histories, with loves, sorrows, resentments, hopes all far advanced and long settled already into three familiar fortunes. He was the one unshackled, as yet unconfined, the one from whom diversion or news or any other of the new worlds a stranger may contain were to be expected, and perhaps desired. For if your fortune at present is not such as pleases you, there is a prospect of mercy, as much as of doom, in the thought that Fortuna is fickle. The goddess's renown is all in her changeableness, and strangers are her acknowledged messengers. They bear with them a glimmering of new chances. When this stranger came forward to the threshold, he could be seen to be a youth of about 24, dressed in plain green, wearing his own hair in short rust-brown curls, smiling in a fashion that crinkled the freckles across his nose, and staring shamelessly. "Hello," he said.
So on the surface, that is a very different sort of novel. But even from that very cursory contact with it, we can see similar things emerging, like the mysterious black servant. And you know that somehow she's going to be more important. She's not going to be just somebody who stands in the corner. She's going to have a voice. There's an element of anachronism about this novel.
There's always an element of anachronism in historical fiction because it's always a negotiation between the priorities of now and what then has to offer. And one of the things you have to do writing about the past is to bring to it, not as an anachronism, but as a kind of refreshment, the present's sense of what's important. And if that doesn't coincide with what would have seemed automatically important, then all the better, because that brings you this beautiful tissue of possible ironies and unexpected moves. And yes, absolutely, the African servant in the room might not have struck some 18th century observers as being terribly important, but when we're in the eyes of Mr. Smith, we are not wholly in the 18th century. I mean, I hope we are partly. It's supposed to, from the language onwards, to be quite deeply embedded in the 18th century, but it's the 18th century as seen from now.
Smith is a sort of picaresque character. He races through the city, although it's set over quite a short period. And that is very much an 18th century form. But within this, you're dealing with, you know, very complicated, very current issues of race relations, homosexuality you deal with, which stands absolutely outside what would be in the terms of reference of a novel.
Well, yes, except that I'm only stretching a kind of real 18th century freedom there, because one of the exciting things, if you spool back to the beginning of the novel, is that they don't yet know what belongs in there. They haven't settled on a set of decorous rules. In particular, they haven't got to the 19th century rules about how you might represent sex and violence and politics and things. So although I am stretching 18th century decorum about what can be represented, I'm not doing total anachronistic violence to it. The picaresque thing was important mainly just as a source of pleasure. I wanted Mr. Smith to have happen to him everything that you could conceivably enjoy about an 18th century novel. So there is a duel and a ball and a trial and a rooftop chase and some...
With a scarf, he gets hauled up. It was almost like Dumas, really, isn't it? I mean, it's sort of...
My secret debt to the Three Musketeers has been ruthlessly exposed here. yes, of course it is, except that, like Sarah wanting to take a trope and do something else with it, Mr. Smith is not an action hero. Mr. Smith, it gradually emerges, is a bit more hapless than that. He's manipulative and charming, but who is to say that he's very good at rooftop escapes or other things? I'm hoping that all these things come at a bit of an angle from what you might expect, while still pushing reliably the buttons of pleasure in the reader.
And one of the things about both these novels is that your evocation of location. And so you're taking us back to a New York, which is totally... You would never have thought that New York would have been like that. You know, a very small town with new settlers. As you said in that passage, they weren't marked by the pox. They didn't have first world diseases yet because they didn't have that degree of contamination in a way. But the dirt and the contact with animals and all those sort of things.
Part of that is just the pleasure of reversal, of proposing, which is historically true, a New York which is so much the opposite of everything you associate with New York now. A New York which is parochial and not very diverse at all and deeply paranoid about difference and otherness and highly religious and not urban, perched on the edge of a continent and in anxious relationship to the wild, to wilderness, which virtually begins just beyond where City Hall Park is now. But I hope, too, you can get a kind of shadow of the city to come in there. And I'm interested in beginnings with this book. There should be visible in there the seeds of a lot of later aspects of American identity. Trump had not happened when I wrote this book, but I like to feel that the book anticipated him anyway. There's, I hope, a rather scary mob scene which has in there that long-running, paranoid, vengeful element in the American psyche, whose latest manifestation is the Donald.
Now, you are the author of a book. You were the author of a book called The Child That Books Built. You're very bookish. One of your things about yourself is you created yourself through reading books. This is an incredibly bookish book. So, for example, there's an echo of a very famous scene in Tristram Shandy involving the conception of Tristram Shandy, which wouldn't be picked up necessarily by anybody who wasn't very familiar with Tristram Shandy. Who is the intended readership of this novel?
It's supposed to be as wide as possible. There are particular little Easter egg-like treats dropped in there for people who happen to notice that I have just repurposed Lawrence Stern's most famous dirty joke from Tristram Shandy. And for that matter, that I've completely anachronistically, I've used a line from Middlemarch while changing the point of view during another quite rude bit of the book, with no excuse at all except that I wanted to. But I want the book, as all books ought to create its own reader to some extent, to give you the basic and pleasurable instructions about how to read this and how to enjoy it, after which you're just kind of off on your own, having a good time with no hand-holding required.
Well, let's just open it out to both of you now and talk about the different oratorial styles in a way that you use. Francis, you play this trick where your narrator doesn't know what's happening in a card game and later in a sword fight, doesn't know the rules of duels. Sarah, you're a specialist in Gothic. You're always conjuring up these Gothic tropes and then turning them on their head in a slightly sort of similar way.
Yes, and I allow, we were talking about, Francis was talking about pleasure earlier, and I wanted to give myself a certain amount of pleasure as the creator, because in my first novel, the narrative voice had been almost entirely embedded in my lead character. And so everything that seemed spooky was spooky because my lead character was seeing it and he didn't understand it. And it was quite a claustrophobic experience. So when I wrote The Essex Serpent, I was very much thinking along the lines of using 19th century novel forms and exploiting them and interrogating them. And obviously the great thing about 19th century fiction is the omniscient narrator. The narrator is a form of God, able simultaneously to kind of fly over a city or and thence into somebody's bedroom in some far distant town, and also to perform some kind of moral or philosophical comment on what was going on. And I largely did that because it was such a change from my debut and because it gave me such pleasure to be able to do. And it meant that the form of the Gothic then changed, because rather than it being a very interior Gothic, which was all about this man's state of mind, which had been what my first book was about, it was more about how the world as a whole could be experienced in several different ways by several different interior minds and several different kind of forms of understanding what they were seeing.
And also you use letters.
Yes, which again was largely for my own benefit, actually. If I've got sort of slightly bored with writing something in the third person, I would slip into a letter because it would give me joy to do. But also because I'm very interested in the idea, which is intrinsic to the Gothic, actually, of what is truth? What is objective reality? Is there really any such thing? Two people could stand on the banks of the Blackwater and observe something. Even now, on sort of a rainy December afternoon in 2016, you and I could stand together on those marshes and look at the Blackwater estuary, go home, write an account of what we saw, and they would differ entirely by our own state of mind, our own anxieties at the time. And so using those letters was a way of examining what is the truth of an encounter. If two people have a conversation, what was really said? Because the conversation is more than the actual sort of recorded words.
Now, both of you, another connection between you, you both have an unusual relationship with religion, don't you? I mean, Francis, you're married to a vicar, you're a practicing Christian. You grew up, Sarah, in a Baptist household. And
you say
you weren't actually given access to literature at all.
No, quite the reverse. Actually, I was not allowed much access to contemporary culture, but classical literature was all over the place. I mean, my father bought me a copy of Tess of the D'Urbervilles when I was 10, absolutely to the horror of my primary school teacher, because I think she knew slightly more about the content of the book than my dad did. So what happened to me was not that I didn't have access to culture, but that rather it was more the sort of culture that would have been around if I'd been brought up in sort of Edwardian time. So no television, pop music, films, that sort of thing.
And to what extent does this influence your choices of where to set things? Do you think it has any influence?
Well, it gave me, among other things, a kind of mental resolution that if I was going to write a book set in the middle of the 18th century, there would be a scene of church going, because people did that quite a lot in the 18th century, but that it would do something functional in the plot, that I would treat it seriously as a piece of social reality rather than just a kind of bizarre expression of the pastness of the past. And I obviously, I am influenced by being a believer myself. My fundamental sense of the shapes of experience has got religion written through it like a stick of rock. But that doesn't mean you need to bang on about it constantly. It's there in the mix. It gives you, I suppose, a particular kind of purchase on those bits of the past which aren't past for you.
It strikes me that this is a bit of a moment for historical fiction. And I know that you two, when you were coming in, were discussing a piece that was in The Guardian, which was suggesting that it was just all about getting big bucks through historical fiction, which isn't really completely true, is it?
No.
They chorused.
So I would contend that, I think it was Hilary Mantel who said this, although I have failed to find the source, but I'm sure it was her. All fiction is historical fiction. If someone wrote a novel in 2012, it would be published probably midway through 2014. And they could have gone to infinite pains to record everything as it was at the time, the musical trends, who was in Parliament, the state of the American nation, for example. And by now, it would be obsolete. It would be a historical piece, and interesting and fascinating as being of its time. The idea that fiction that is set in the past is in some way cowardly or irrelevant is absolutely ludicrous. Good historical fiction is not about the past, it is about now. And, for example, Golden Hill, there is a scene in Golden Hill which I found absolutely terrifying, which is a kind of sectarian glee around bonfires, and it's sort of a little bit like the equivalent of the Lewis bonfire night now, but in the mid-18th
century.
That's in
Lewis, where they have this great big effigy absolutely, burning yeah. in the south of England.
Yes, and I think whenever I'd read that scene, I would have found it very chilling as an evocation of a kind of quasi-nationalistic sectarian fervour, which is very dangerous, like a kind of tinderbox of violence. Reading it post-Trump, it does feel prophetic. And so good historical fiction comments on the present and continues to comment on the changing present. So Middlemarch was a historical novel. It was commenting on George Eliot's present as it was written, and it can still comment in its kind of expansiveness and its universality on our own present now. And, you know, Middlemarch deals with kind of housing and medicine and so on. So I feel, as you can see, fairly exercised about claiming historical fiction as being as relevant and as urgent as any other form.
This is something we've fumed about earlier. Let me return the compliment. In Sarah's book, what there is a marvellous demonstration that the late 19th century, looked at from the particular angle she does, is the kind of the antechamber of now. She has deliberately picked out the most modern aspects of the 1890s, so that people travel on the tube, that Essex has a relationship to London that, you know, we will recognise perfectly straightforwardly from now. And what she does with it is to anticipate and explore a lot of what has been going on in the culture wars of the last 20 and 30 years about religion and science, unexpectedly and not schematically, because, like good bits of imagining, she's not interested in casting the armies of faith and science in stereotypical terms. One thing we haven't said yet is that The Essex Serpent is, among other things, a love story, a rather complicated one, between Cora, the Darwinian fossil hunter, and William, the anti-superstitious vicar. It's about the union of apparent contraries and about discovering unexpected affinities and similarities. Tell me where that is a period piece about the 1890s.
There's one thing that they both have in them on a rather more mundane level, which is coffee.
Yep.
And I thought that was fascinating, you know, in the 18th century. Well, tell us what coffee means in these two novels.
Oh, 18th century coffee is the caffeinated visible sign that the modern world is happening and where heartbeats and everything else are about to accelerate. Mr. Smith comes from London, which is the grand metropolis of Europe at that point, with more people in it than any other city. So he seeks out a coffee house when he lands in New York and is dismayed to find that there are only two of them, when he's used to there being hundreds of highly specialised coffee houses that offer very different kinds of experiences, one for sort of meat porters, one for actors, one for wigs, one for and so on and so on. Instead of which, he has to make do with a generic coffee house. But I'm going to drink some too right now.
It's a proto-hipster, isn't he? Sort of insisting on his... I wish I could remember which 19th century novel first made me kind of sit up and go, God, of course, they went out for coffee. I don't think it was Diary of a Nobody, but I'm just fascinated. I think it may very well be, actually.
Henry Gissing.
Yes, I think so. It was a comic or light fiction. And I'm fascinated in not the differences between us and the past, but the sameness. And so finding these little things, you know, that the scene with Smith fulminating over the paucity of types of coffee was exactly like somebody walking around Dalston going, you know, I can't believe I can't get a flat white here.
Well, in your novel, Martha is outraged by the coffee, the standard
That's
of the
right.
coffee in rural Essex.
And there are a few things that I had to actually remove from the final draft of the novel because they were slightly beyond the reader's belief. So, for example, you could go to Debenhams and Sainsbury's in the 1890s, and I did actually insert them, but that seemed a little bit too much like digging the reader in the ribs with a very sharp elbow and saying, look how modern the 1890s were. But, you know, if people wanted to meet up for a chat, they would go for a cup of coffee in a cafe.
Although, if you don't do it too strongly and trigger their antibodies of disbelief too powerfully, I think there is a particular sly little pleasure in getting your reader to disbelieve in something that is, in fact, historically authentic.
Sarah Perry's The Essex Serpent is published, appropriately enough, by Serpent's Tale, and Frances Spufford's Golden Hill by Faber and Faber. The Costa Award category winners will be announced on the 3rd of January.
This Guardian podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
It has not perhaps been a good year for humankind, but it has been a good year for writing, according to our own in-house team of Claire Armitstead and Sean Kane, who summoned singer-songwriter Emma Lee Moss, also known as Emmy the Great, to reminisce about the high points of the reading year. Emmy, as regular listeners to this podcast will know, is a serious bookworm who joins us every now and then to share her enthusiasms. Having exchanged lists in the weeks before, the three of them discovered that Naomi Alderman's book, The Power, was the one book on all of their lists. So Claire began by asking Emmy what she'd enjoyed about it.
So I heard it on Radio 4 as the book at bedtime, and I was intrigued. I started listening about a third of a way into the story, and I gradually figured out that we were living in a world where the women were in the position that men are in now. So I went out and I bought this book and I was very excited. And I still think the premise is staggering and I love it and I think about that all the time. But the actual book itself, the story follows this almost movie thriller plot, and that let me down a little bit. You really loved that, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, that was the thing, that we had her on the podcast and I said to her, I feel bad for liking the book for this reason, but I think its real strength is how cinematic it feels. And she said later on, and it's now news, that it has been picked up for TV, and you can see just how suitable this book is going to be for some sort of visual adaptation.
Just for people who don't know what it is, say a bit about what it is.
So The Power is all about the idea that women have this dormant gland in their bodies that's linked to their sex, which means that they can let off an electrical charge. And this charge, when women start discovering that they have it and that they can control it, it sets about this whole new world order where women are suddenly no longer suppressed or at the mercy of men because of their physical size. They suddenly, that's no longer a factor anymore. And it's a really, really interesting book because it does take into political realities that we all know. So she looks at what happens in Saudi Arabia when all of the women suddenly have a huge amount of power. What happens in African countries, for example. And also what happens in American politics. It's really, really interesting. I really loved it. I was saying to Emmy before that I really love how accessible it feels because it's such a big idea. And feminism is one of those things that people do feel uncomfortable talking about or identifying as such. And I think this book will actually do something for that conversation.
It also, although it starts off as a fantasy of female empowerment, and they're quite cartoony, the figures, it gets much, much darker and more complicated, doesn't it? And it doesn't gloss over the fact that if women were to have the power that men have, they're going to do a lot of the same bad things.
Yeah, I mean, that was my favourite thing about it, yeah. Because the book is framed as a historical novel that's been written thousands of years in the future by a male writer writing to a sort of Naomi Alderman type mentor. And the language, this is my favourite thing about the book. It's so clever. The language that she uses to him is sort of like gently flirtatious and like slightly derogatory, but in a kind of hidden way saying, oh, well, don't worry your pretty head about these big ideas. And that to me was the most daring thing about the whole book, is that it imagined a safe and stable world beyond all of these cataclysmic events, which is very much like our own, but everything is just flipped.
I love the fact that his email signature said he belonged to a men's writers group, which I just thought was the best, because I was like, oh yeah, it is ridiculous, isn't it? But I think that one of my favourite graphic novel series is a book called Why the Last Man, which is all about what would happen if all the men on the earth died except for one. And it's a similar, it goes through similar an exploration of what women would do, because it does refute that idea that women would be entirely peaceful and not instigate wars and there'd be no conflict. It sort of gets rid of quite a frankly patronising idea and go, no, women would rise up and start seeking power.
Talking about women rising up, that it has been quite a good year for novels by women, hasn't it? I mean, there have been lots of really, really strong titles.
I mean, Sarah Perry, for example, I think that's one of my favourite books of the year.
Zadie Smith is one, Swing Time. That, Emmy, yeah, is one of yours.
That was one of my favourite books.
Why are you so passionate about that? I feel that book's slightly missed its mark.
That a lot of people, I read the reviews. I always read reviews after because I'm a bit hungry for more of the book, but I finished the book. And I was surprised by that. It's actually my favourite novel of Zadie Smith. And I think it's because it's so disillusioned. And maybe that's the Zadie Smith of our time. It's our 2016 Zadie Smith just happens to have not the same level of optimism as she did when she started out, and maybe none of us do either.
And it's very musical, dancey.
Here's the other thing, is that it just happens that in this year, the favourite things that I've seen culturally have been dance. And I think that's because dance goes to a place where we can't use words or overthink things, and it expresses feelings in a kind of visceral human way. And that's what I really connected to in this. It was a sense of beyond thinking, beyond even books, we still have these rhythms and this human way of communicating.
And it's the story of two friends, childhood friends, who both want to be dancers, and one is talented and one isn't.
Yeah, well, it's set in Northwest London, like most of Zadie Smith's books, and it follows two young girls, mixed race girls, as they go through school years and then separate when one goes to university and the other goes to the West End as a chorus girl. And then one of them has this sort of crazy outlandish job where she becomes overnight the assistant to a superstar pop artist, some kind of amalgam of Kylie and Madonna. And she goes on this journey where she's sort of trailing the 1% but not truly living her life, while her friend is living a much, much less privileged life and is slowly descending into the traps that they always feared they would growing up where they did. But she has children and she is living her life, and it's this kind of question of which one of them has the fuller life.
The whole idea of celebrity as well is so current, isn't it?
Yeah, well, because Zadie Smith is such a superstar, I gave her words a lot of weight in regards to that kind of lifestyle. I was interested. I was like, is this something she's observed? It's a very kind portrait, and it doesn't fall into that trap. It's hard to write someone who's living a dream life in a kind of authentic way, because maybe they just don't have lifestyles that your average reader can relate to. But she writes this character, Amy, in a very interesting and neutral, generous way, which I thought was really cool. And although ostensibly the whole novel is about dance because they want to be dancers, and the author, I mean the narrator, who doesn't have a name throughout the book, she also ends up in Africa and she observes like this ritualistic dance that changes her life. And then they talk about Michael Jackson, they talk about a tap dancer who was lost during the golden age of Hollywood. Although that is the front portion of the book's ideas, it's also very much about the story of motherhood and the dialogue that every woman is kind of in with society about motherhood. And I found that really illuminating, especially for me in my life where I am at the moment.
Moving on to non-fiction, one of the overlap books is Amy Liptrot's The Outrun, which is another book that I didn't feel quite got its due, although it did win the Jeffrey Wainwright Prize for Nature Writing.
Yes.
I interviewed Amy after she won that, and I said, oh, how did you celebrate? And she celebrated by skinny dipping in the Isis River.
afterwards. She goes skinny dipping off the Orkneys, which it must be very cold at New Year.
Yeah. I kind of loved that about her. Like, I loved, after speaking to her, I got a real sense that her voice in the book was very similar to how she is in person. And I love that very vulnerable honesty that I feel like I've read a lot of in female memoir recently. It's sort of, there's that term confessional writing that is all too dismissive sometimes, that it gets assigned to women too often. But this is a really, it puts her in a really vulnerable position, this book, and she comes from a really dark place at the start, and it's not necessarily a, you know, journey of redemption or anything, but I really valued getting to read where she started from and where she ended up at the end.
So she starts off as a party girl who's come down from the middle of nowhere. Obviously, if you live in Orkney, you don't think it's the middle of nowhere, but a remote farm, down to it's a really happening East London, and completely lost her head, really, and got very into drugs and alcohol and rock and roll.
Yeah.
And then has to go back and goes back to Orkney to find herself. And one of the brilliant things I think about it is the way that she uses technology. Mm. So, you know, you think that that would be, you know, mobile phones and social networks would be the devil, but actually they're what keep her sane and give her a whole new connection to the land. Yeah. So if she gets lonely, she points her phone up to the plane that she sees going overhead, and she can tell where it's going to and where it's coming from.
Yeah.
And she does the same for birds that she sees.
Yeah.
She's just very connected. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. What did you think of her voice as a writer?
Oh, I thought I was really interested in it because she's not at all self-pitying.
Yeah.
But she is raw. And that's a very difficult balance to get, isn't it?
Mm, yeah, no, I agree. I think raw is a very good word for it.
But we've got a few non-fiction books on this. And Emmy, I was really interested to think of you struggling away, not struggling away, but it would be me struggling away with Seven Brief Lessons on Physics. Carlo Rovelli, which tops the Amazon sector, which is physics.
Is that a big selling?
Big selling physics book.
But have you seen the book?
No.
I'm just holding
it. Oh, it's a tiddler,
about half
is it?
An inch. It's so simple. I picked it up in an airport and I read it on the flight, and I got off and I was just like, the world is so elegant. You know, it's a beautiful book. I also read Homo Deus as the other nonfiction book that I read this year.
Which was Yuval Noah Harari.
Right.
Yeah, that's one of mine too.
Which is it's gigantic. And the difference between the two is staggering in terms of what it does to you. After Seven Brief Lessons on Physics, I had spent this time thinking about my own insignificance and the elegance and the doubt of science. And then you read Homo Deus and it's all about humans and everything that we've done and all our ways of destroying what we were given. And I felt that the physics book was kind of a luxury because it allowed you to look outwards. And I think the difference between the two is that Homo Deus is biology, and that forces you to look at yourself, which is a different picture.
Although, actually, there have been quite a few books this year about the Anthropocene and the fact that we are actually creating a new geological era, because we are so massive now, we're like a glacier. And we have that effect on in the absence, increasingly, of glaciers. It's humanity that's changing everything.
A confused and belligerent glacier. What did you think of Homo Deus? I love it so much, but it's terrifying as well.
Yeah, I think that, I sort of think that it should be in the way that people have suddenly have these campaigns to post a book to every MP, which seems to be a bit of a fashion at the moment. That should be sent to every US congressman.
Should crowdfund a few copies.
There is this one line that I underlined for my dad and my boyfriend to read, where it says, this is about, I've been reading a lot about climate change this year as well, because obviously it's something that we're having to face post US election. And he has this one passage about how the super rich are still holding out for a high-tech solution, and so they're not going to make any changes because they think there's going to be a high-tech arc and they're going to be on it. And this is what he says. People who believe in the high-tech arc should not be put in charge of the global ecology, for the same reason that people who believe in a heavenly afterlife should not be given nuclear weapons. and I underlined it maybe 3 times, although I don't know, now I have that knowledge, what I can do
what
about
you can
it.
Do with it.
He doesn't tell you
maybe,
that.
Maybe some T-shirts with one half of it on the front and one side of it, half of it on the other.
Well, maybe it would help a little bit.
I'm interested that you turn down the corners. You dog-ear your books.
Yeah.
Do you dog-ear books?
No.
You see, I am a dog-earer, and I think that readers divide into two categories. And I was delighted. I went to interview the great academic and literary historian biographer Gillian Beer in Cambridge the other day, and what she does to her books doesn't bear thinking about. We had this long discussion about people who mistreat and people who revere books and the different ways of revering books.
Well, because I eat a lot of noodles and I read while I... So I've decided ages ago that I was never going to keep my books pristine.
Because you have noodles all over them.
Splatter.
It's just noodles and spaghetti all over my books all the time. So I decided that I'd be an abuser of books.
I don't feel like I'm precious about books because I don't dog-ear them. But I certainly... I think I developed a habit because I read a lot of Choose Your Own Adventure books as a child. Mm. And I've developed a habit of sort of weaving my fingers through pages that I enjoyed. Like a spider as I read. It's quite an uncomfortable way of reading, but I don't dog-ear because I have that sort of way of going, oh, the index.
And do you lie them on their face so that the spine cracks open? That's all right.
The only time I've drawn a line was when, I remember when we did the Infinite Jest podcast and we were talking about people cutting up books. I don't really do that.
Burglar it does feel a bit, books. Yeah. It feels wrong.
It does.
It felt really bad.
Well, let's get back to the books that we haven't slaughtered this year. Emmy, I was very interested to see the Cynthia Dapri Sweeney on your list, The Nest.
Ah, did you guys read that one?
Mm, no.
It was kind of a...
It's a debut.
It's a debut. The writer was 50 when it was published. She received a book advance that was something like $1 million. So it was impossible to... read any reviews that didn't mention this.
It was described in The Guardian as almost tyrannically entertaining.
Yeah.
That's nice.
It's a compulsive read, but I don't know that it's lingered with me afterwards. I spent more time wondering if one of the characters in the book is based on the editor of N+1 magazine than I have thinking about any other concept or character in the book. Unfortunately, I think the most interesting thing about the book is its success. But it will—I think it will definitely be a TV series or a movie, and that would be fantastic because I think the story is snappy and it's fun, but it's not chewy.
Now, your other favourite, along with Swing Time, is The Good Immigrant, which loads of people have recommended this Christmas. And it's a book I've given away for Christmas quite a lot because it's got so much. You can just dip into it. All different sorts of people can read it.
Well, I've been giving it away. I started, after I bought it, the US election happened. And I was feeling so vulnerable and sad that I started travelling with The Good Immigrant in my bag. It was so strange. I finished it already. And I'd be like, oh, I'm flying to a show. I think I'll just take The Good Immigrant. And then I'd get somewhere and I'd meet someone and I'd give it to them because it feels like one of these books that you want to spread out into the world.
And it's 21 stories by emerging voices for Asian, Black.
BAME.
That's what we call people now, is BAME.
I think that's what Nikesh described it as.
Nikesh Shukla was the editor.
Right, exactly. Yeah. When he was crowdfunding it. It was emerging.
And so it's crowdfunded. Is that not a wonderful thing to have happened this year?
It's such a nice little victory for Unbound, who are the group that put it together. It was just sort of, it's been a nice story from start to finish, really. Because I mean, J.K. Rowling put in $5,000 for the fund, and it really quickly exceeded its target. And it got nominated for Reader's Book of the Year this year, which is really, really nice.
So just to bring it back, full circle, we like full circles on this podcast, to the Costa shortlists. They're shortly going to be announced. And we've both recommended a couple of the other books that we haven't talked about yet.
But yeah.
Sebastian Barry is probably the going to win it, isn't he?
I kind of hope so. I mean, I love Sarah Perry, but I'm about halfway through Days Without End, and it's just such a beautiful piece of writing. I never actually read Sebastian Barry before. And I wrote our news story about the Costa news, so I called him, and he was such a delightful man to speak to on the phone that I was like, oh, I really should pick this up because I just enjoyed our conversation so much. God, it's a beautiful piece of writing. It's just such a wonderful... it's set during the American Civil War, and is told from
the perspective of Thomas McNulty, who's an Irishman who's fled the potato famine, basically, hasn't he?
Yeah, and he's just got this wonderful twang in his voice, and it's quite a hard voice to read, but it actually forces you to slow down and sort of relish each sentence. And even talking about things as horrid as scalping Indians and things, it's still got a strange beauty to it. Really admirable. I think it's a book that I always think about when I'm not reading, which is a good sign.
And the other one I really loved was Rose Tremaine's The Gustav Sonata.
Yeah, what was that?
Short, absolutely lovely. It's about a man who is sort of a human personification of Switzerland values, i.e. he's neutral. And it's the possibility of living with neutrality and the cost of it, really. Mm. And it's just beautifully played out. It's very musical. It's very, compared with a lot of the novels of the year, it's properly slight, not at all in stature, but in volume. Mm. And it just feels incredibly elegant. And I just think the Costa list has been fantastic. I think probably a better list than the Booker list. Yeah. And it's the list that's going to carry 2016 forward into 2017.
Yeah, well, a bunch of these are all out in hardback and will be out in paperback in 2017. So
that's when the real reading begins. So just, okay, very, very last thing. Which is the book of all the books that you've read in 2016 that is the one that you will keep if you have to get rid of all the others?
Can I go last?
Oh, God. I'm going to say The Power, just because I'm really excited to see what that book is going to do, both just in terms of book sales, in terms of conversation, in terms of when it inevitably dominates Netflix or whatever it's on, what people will take from it. I'm really excited about that.
I think it would be Good Immigrant, just because I could give it away to someone and spread it around more.
And I think I would actually go for Homo Deus, the Yuval Noah Harari, because you could just read it again and again and again, couldn't you? And also it will help you to have the conversations that need to be had with people.
I think mine is Homo Deus as well. Oh. I have to, like, it's so difficult because there's something about it it makes me think that I don't want to take it because it's so scary, but maybe it provides a kind of reality check minute by minute about being a human.
And the consequences that we could visit upon everything, exactly. the whole of creation, really.
It's a reality check.
Well, this whole year might have been a bit of a reality check for us all, but there's still so much good and principled writing out there, and we have enjoyed sharing it with you. We always value your input, your comments, your tweets. Do keep them coming in. We start 2017 as we mean to go on, with a unique interview with the legendary Last Poets, the 1960s civil rights activists who made poetry powerful. Do join us. Many thanks to Sarah Perry, Frances Spufford, and to Emmy the Great. Her latest album is out now, called Second Love, and you can catch her international tour dates on emmythegreat.com. It's her music that's accompanying us out, a song called See You Next Year from her Christmas album with Tim Wheeler.
Close your eyes until today becomes tomorrow, and the two of us are standing at the start of a new year. Still have had too much to drink. We'll still be nowhere closer to knowing what we're doing here.
For more literary interviews, discussions, and live events, just search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can find us at theguardian.com, on iTunes, on SoundCloud, or on your smartphone. Just look for us via your favourite podcast app. But for now, from me, Susanna Tresillian, and all of us at the Guardian Books Podcast, thank you and a Happy New Year to you all.
When our eyes reopen, well, we won't be that much taller. We won't know any secrets that we didn't know before. But before the morning comes, the two of us might just discover what our hearts are for. So I'll see you tomorrow. I'll see you next year. Oh, I'll see you tomorrow. I'll see you next year.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.